back, folks. Newcomers, excuse our hillbilly music. We have a lot of people who live on the farm, like I do, although I don't sound it, I've been told. We'd like to make you all feel at home. I don't even know where to begin, folks. There's so much going on. There's so many wonderful things to report to you. Let me tell you what's coming in the program. I will bring you a wonderful story of my interview of a most cordial FBI agent, really a lovely fellow, intelligent fellow, a credit to the agency, a specialist in international terrorism. We had some good discussion of that, I might add. And an interview of a local state police official, another very fine fellow. And you might say they almost fell off their chairs when I showed up at a meeting where I wasn't invited and introduced myself. I'll tell you about that later on in the program. I think you'll really enjoy it. I know there's a core audience who will love that story. Lord willing, I hope to bring you that now famous, some might say infamous letter, the letter that was heard around the world. Curiously, even though no one's seen it, has it occurred to anybody, especially in the media, why the governors have not released the letter itself, but only a statement about it? Well, later on, you'll see why. And this is the letter that was sent to all of the men and women who occupied the office of governor with a capital G in the former states. That may sound like hogwash to people who don't know what I'm talking about, but it's absolutely true, because those offices were reclaimed into a de jure non-corporate capacity by way of that process. And I'll also have comments, hopefully, Lord willing, line by line, so our listeners tonight will know exactly what was intended instead of relying upon speculation by talking heads who've never met us, never met me, never read the document, but are certainly free to and have taken the liberty to speculate ad nauseum, as tends to be the case on much of the network news nowadays. Anyway, who am I? For those who don't know, my name is Sam Kennedy, Samuel Thomas Bartholomew Kennedy, and I'm basically just an ordinary guy who woke up one day and said, like many others, enough is enough. It is time to end the insanity. Now, many of you are thinking, what insanity? And there are many more of you who are saying to yourselves, Sam, we know exactly what you mean. We've known things are not right most of our lives. Well, let me ask your indulgence before I get on to the real meat of the program. Let me ask you a few simple questions off the top of my head, folks. And these questions, let's call these the honest American questions, especially for all those investigative journalists and news anchors and people of goodwill and high intellect who consider themselves sophisticated in their political knowledge, insiders, connoisseurs of government, so to speak, and the political process. Where do we begin? How about this? How many of you folks listening tonight remember growing up with the belief that the American economy is the strongest in history? Now, I remember that just presciently from my childhood. We always grew up with the impression that America was the place to be. We did it better than anybody, and we were, in fact, immune from the laws of history. Well, here's my question. If America has the most powerful economy in the world, why did it collapse over a single weekend on news of a sole corporate bankruptcy back during the economic collapse? When was that? The fall of 2008, I believe. How strong can the economy be if it can tank on the misstatements or an anxiety-creating word or two from the chairman of the Fed or the president when they utter a few impromptu words that may have not been indicated? Why was every politician in sight when that happened on the evening news, on the late night news, on the Sunday news program saying the same thing? We don't know what happened. We don't know how much debt we owe. We don't know if $700 billion is enough, and on and on and on. Was the most incredible display of political non-knowledge I had ever seen in my life. If our economy is so strong, How could it collapse on a single report of a corporate bankruptcy? You think maybe something is going on that you're not aware of. Even those of you who hold yourselves out as experts on various television business news programs. So here's another question for those experts and for the rest of us. For those of you who think you own your own home, and that's probably a majority of the audience, why does the deed to that home call you a tenant on your own land? And if you're the tenant, who's the landlord? I had this discussion yesterday with both the FBI and state police, and it was an eye-opener when we explored it. And why didn't your real estate attorney pause to ask? If you were to ask your attorney, if there are 1,000 attorneys listening tonight, I'll bet there's not one among you who has the answer to that question. I don't say that to put you down at all. It's a reality. I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of attorneys and prosecutors and judges. I consider every one of those conversations to be a blessing. And not one has ever known the answer to that question, including yesterday. And by the way, it has nothing to do with, oh, that's the way we do it in the legal system. Because if there's one thing you learn from former President Clinton, it's that it all depends on the meaning of the word is. The use of legal terminology, the Bar Association legal franchise terminology, is very specific, whereas the rest of the world operates under the true law, where we don't need a billion pages to interpret thou shalt not steal. That's a pretty simple one for most of us. Here's my $64,000 question. Are you aware that in 1912, $1 bought a steak dinner for two, actually two and a half. The little baby could eat steak too. Just as it had in 1789. Can you even conceive of a world where not only wasn't inflation ever known for 125 years, but the actual economic model until the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was gradual deflation as the cost of producing goods is diminished by paying off the cost of the capital equipment. How come no economist on one of the business news programs has ever brought that fact out? And by the way, you can confirm every word of this simply. You don't even have to go to a law library. Just Google inflation charts for the United States. You'll find a very simple one pre-1912, a flat line slightly reducing towards 1912. A dollar bought a steak dinner for two in 1789 and a steak dinner for two and a half in 1912. That's a fact. Here's another one to add to that book of facts. Are you aware that a barrel of oil costs approximately 1/6 to 1/10 of an ounce of gold, just as it did in 1974 during the so-called oil crisis and in 1935? And throughout all of modern history, ever since gold was pulled out of circulation in 1933, gold could reach $5,000 an ounce next year, but still a sixth of an ounce of gold will always buy, or somewhere between a sixth and a tenth, will always buy a barrel of crude. We never had an oil crisis, and not one reporter, and I look at you folks as with distinction, by the way. I know how hard you work. I know how well-trained you are and how strongly you believe what you believe. Not one of you ever stepped forward in 74. I know. I was glued to the television and said, folks, we don't have an oil crisis. We have a dollar crisis. And it's been that way since 1933. Here's another question off the top of my head. And excuse me if I sound disjointed. I want to find something to read to you if I can. Are you folks aware that the Federal Reserve Bank is privately owned? It is not a government agency. It has shares that are owned by formerly 8 and now 7 banking families around the world, including the Rothschild banks of England and Berlin, Rockefeller and Morgan families through J.P. Morgan and Chase and so on. The Warburg brothers, the legacy that they left through, I think it's Warburg Company and Goldman Sachs and formerly Lehman Brothers, among others. There's also a well-known bank in Italy that has its hand in the pie. But let me read you something, and I apologize. I never, ever read from statutes of the United States Federal Corporation, and we'll have more to say about that shortly. But let me read to you from the Ninth Circuit Court, a case called Lewis versus United States, June 24th, 1982. We conclude that the Federal Reserve banks are not federal, but are independent, privately owned, and locally controlled corporations without day-to-day direction from the federal government. Folks, that's your Supreme Court talking, not me. Let me read you something else. Probably from the last great American statesman, a fellow by the name of Congressman Lewis McFadden. He was chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee in 1934. So arguably the most knowledgeable man in the world on banking and currency back when the New Deal, a New Deal, was sprung upon us. And here's what he said in speeches to Congress. Most people don't know this, that Lewis McFadden brought charges as chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee for conspiracy, fraud, as I recall, unlawful conversion, and treason against the Secretary of the Treasury, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the governors of the Federal Reserve Bank. Folks, check your history. Those charges still exist. They never made it out of committee. They were never voted up or down. And I'll tell you exactly what Lewis McFadden said to open Congress, and it is scathing. And it's the story of the century, and everyone's missed it. We'll be back after a brief commercial message.
Hi, welcome to America. Glad you made it. On the left, you'll notice a coin slot. Insert dollars only, please. I got no
bread for welcome back, folks. Well, I guess that bump in music is appropriate for what we're about to tell you. Here is what Congressman Lewis McFadden, this fellow was a genuine statesman, willing to stand up and put his life on the line for truth. Here's what he said to the Congress of 1934. Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks, hereinafter called the Fed. The Fed has cheated the government of these United States and the people of the United States out of enough money to pay the nation's debt. And by the way, folks, this is the organization whose representatives we see all over the media giving us their expertise in what the Fed is doing about inflation. When Newsweek said the Fed is concerned with inflation, they weren't kidding. They're concerned with creating just enough of it to rob the people of their wealth. And by the way, that's not me talking. That's the former head of the House Banking and Currency Committee. He went on to say, this evil institution, strong words for congressmen, has impoverished and ruined the people of these United States, has bankrupted itself, and has practically bankrupted our government through the defects of the law under which it operates and the corrupt practices of the moneyed vultures who control it. This is all in the first two or three paragraphs. And then he went on to say, some people think that the Federal Reserve Banks are United States government institutions. They are private monopolies which prey upon the people of these United States for the benefit of themselves and their foreign customers. They are foreign and domestic speculators and swindlers and rich and predatory money lenders. In that dark crew of financial pirates, there are those who would cut a man's throat to get a dollar bill out of his pocket. And there are those who would send money into states to buy votes to control our legislatures. I don't even have to read any more. I think you've heard a mouthful. And for those of you who would like more information on the Fed, it's out there. The biggest story of the last 150 years, if you choose to look for it. You could look up the speeches on Google. You could read Secrets of the Fed by Eustace Mullins, who's still alive and kicking. Very nice fellow. You could read The Money Masters on DVD, or listen to it rather. You could read Tupper Saucy's wonderful book, Miracle on Main Street, which was received by great critical review, I might add. Here's another question for all of us who consider, for those of us who have strong beliefs about the world we see around us. How many of you have been excited when the stock market passed 10,000? Do you remember that? I remember that very clearly. And so my question is very simple. 10,000 what? A point? A dollar? What? A point? Well, what's a point? I'll bet you if we have 15 million people listening tonight, 14,999,000 and change would not know what a point is. And yet we have all that excitement over something we don't even understand. Well, let me ask you, would you rather have a stock market at $10,000 when a steak dinner costs $65, or a market at 1,000, whatever that is, 1,000 points, when a steak dinner costs $1? See, my point is, it's all razzle-dazzle. They have us debating all kinds of things to distract from the reality, and the reality is that we have placed our children's future and their future wealth and their future welfare into a market, so to speak, that's nothing other than a gambling emporium. How did the entire society get sucked into gambling as a way of life? That's what we do. In fact, we have entire programs on television all day long that speculate about that gambling. Have we forgotten the lessons that our grandparents taught us, that gambling is an evil and it's a sin? What would our grandparents actually have thought about that? That we've been duped into believing that we should buy into a company based upon the demand, the value is based upon the demand for its stock rather than the material goods, the value of its services and goods and its capital assets. It makes no sense. It's insanity. And that's what I mean by insanity. We've accepted insanity as normal. There's insanity all around us. You get stopped by a police officer. You know you have to cooperate. And if you don't have a piece of paper in your pocket that shows that you have confessed to being a subject class citizen of the United States, and I'll explore what that means in a few minutes, he might break the window, pull you out, and there's a risk you would die for lack of a piece of paper. Now, is that not insanity? Should people be dying if they don't have a piece of paper, or if they refuse to say, I wish to submit as a subject class citizen of the United States instead of a sovereign owner of the United States Federal Corporation? It makes no sense. And here's the last one. This one I can't stay away from. You know, this is one of the myths that's most frequently populated throughout the media. It's so easy to traffic in sound bites and one-liners and pin people into the corner when you're going to commercial break in 30 seconds. I can see Alan Combs, just like now we're going to break, I can see Alan Combs and Anderson Cooper saying, so you don't believe in paying your fair share? Not realizing for a minute that the Lord doesn't allow strangers to come to you and say, tell me every piece of your personal business. Tell me every dollar you own. Tell me about every transaction you did in your life. And then send me part of your sweat equity. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back, folks. All right. I'd like to read you a very short excerpt from the cover letter to the Grace Report back in 1984. Those of you who have been around a while remember Peter Grace, J. Peter Grace. He was the Warren Buffett of his time, an older fellow, very likable, very wise, and he was appointed by Ronald Reagan to head the Grace Commission, the most extensive investigation of economies in this country that's ever been undertaken. Cover page of his report, cover letter, and I believe this may have been on page one, if not page two, he said the following. With two-thirds of everyone's personal income taxes wasted or not collected, 100% of what is collected is absorbed solely by interest on the federal debt and by federal government contributions to transfer payments. In other words, all individual income tax revenues are gone before one nickel is spent on the services which taxpayers expect from their government. That was January 12, 1984. What he said was, the income tax exists to pay the interest to the Federal Reserve Bank and its private owners, because not one penny goes to the goods and services that you all argue about on television until we can't stand it anymore. You talk about, well, how can we afford this? How can we afford that? Taxes will have to go up. It's an equation. It's a false equation that you have been fed. It's hard to believe because you've spent countless hours debating it on television without the substance. Right there, J. Peter Grace gave you the story of the century, and no one took it. I'll give tell you another story of the century. Back in 1973, the Senate Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency published a report, fascinating report, in which it was called the it was the Senate Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency final report. It was headed by Frank Church, and I'm going to look for the exact quote from it, but within the foreword, I should find it in just a section. Here it is. Within the actual foreword to that, very first paragraph, very first sentence, it said, since March 9th, 1933, the United States has been in a state of declared national emergency. Actually, it's been in a state of emergency since 1918, other than one brief period when Woodrow Wilson withdrew the national emergency. It goes on to say, these proclamations give force to 470 provisions of federal law which delegate to the president extraordinary powers ordinarily exercised by the Congress, which affect the lives of American citizens in a host of all-encompassing manners. This vast range of powers taken together confer enough authority to rule the country without reference to normal constitutional processes. And you wonder why you see the things you do, why you accept executive orders as if they're law. It goes on to say, the president may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, how can such a thing be, restrict travel, and in a plethora of particular ways control the lives of all American citizens. You might want to Google Senate Report 93-549 to get a clue as to what's really going on, and that the 1,300 people who sent every governor a letter, as you'll see later, are not acting contrary to your best interests. We have the interests of the sovereign people of America, our children and grandchildren and the posterity, at heart in absolutely everything that we do. So before you're quick to jump to an opinion, may I suggest a little bit of research would be in order. Anyway, I'd like to move on to this FBI interview. It's sort of an amusing story. Before I do, just one other thing. And if there's nothing else you hear during this program, please hear this, especially my friends in the media. You remember when $700 billion was postulated as the amount that might be sufficient to save the country from imminent economic collapse. By the way, it didn't. We're headed there. In fact, we even know the timing of it. And of all the questions that were asked, no one ever asked the one question that should have been asked right off the bat: where does the $700 billion come from? Newsweek published an article. I remember it well. The headline said, 11 questions about the $700 billion bailout that no one's asking. Well, Newsweek, there should have been a 12th. What's the source of the money? So let me take two minutes to tell you the source of the money, folks. And some of you know this in your heart, but it's the most amazing thing that you will hear in your lifetime, because it's been happening before your eyes, and virtually everything that you know about the world will change if you just hear what happened with the $700 billion. That $700 billion That transaction was handled electronically as book entries at the Depository Trust Company in New York City at 55 Water Street. But for the sake of demonstration, let's talk about it like it's still paper currency. Because, you know, there's less than, I think, 8% of currency is actually paper currency, what we call money of exchange. The rest is money of account. Anyway, forget about all of that. Here's what happened. We need $700 billion. The Federal Reserve, a privately owned bank, went to the Bureau of Engraving, a subdivision of the Department of Treasury, and ordered $700 billion, let's say in $1,000 bills. And their cost for that printing is 4 cents per bill. Back in 1913, when both the Federal Reserve Act and the Income Tax Act were passed, no coincidence there, they both passed in the same year, it was 2.6 cents a bill. Simultaneously, the Department of Treasury prints $700 billion in bonds. And it was Thomas Jefferson who had a marvelous quote most people probably would not understand that said, if the United States can print a dollar bill, it can print a dollar bond. And so then, if you believe Newsweek and Time and most everybody, in fact, even people Glenn Beck has had on his programs who have stood there and said, and then the Fed buys those bonds. So in other words, the $700 billion in cash that the Fed printed is used to buy those bonds. Well, I've got news for you, news for my friends in the media, men and women I love and admire. You can't buy a bond. You rent a bond. A bond is a promissory note. I ought to know. I've written more promissory notes and taught more people how to write promissory notes and bonds than anyone in this country. In fact, I offered to give a seminar on it to the local FBI office in Syracuse just yesterday. A bond is a promissory note. It's a loan. If you buy, quote unquote, buy a GE bond for $10,000, when that bond matures, you take it out of your drawer, you bring it down to a Federal Reserve Bank, and you cash it in. It goes back to GE. And GE pays you the $10,000 back plus interest. You didn't buy the bond. You rented it. That's how legal jargon is used to injure you and your children. So now, Treasury takes possession of the $700 billion in cash, puts it into circulation. And the Fed takes the $700 billion in bonds, Treasury bonds, and sends it down to the Depository Trust Company to be placed on deposit, and then they trade against that $700 billion, making oodles and oodles more money behind the scenes with the loan that you just issued. And when those bonds mature, the Fed calls them back up from DTC, the Depository Trust Company, and says to the Department of Treasury, please pull that $700 billion back out of circulation. And now the exchange happens again, and the United States buys the bonds back, pays off the bonds, so to speak, by delivering $700 billion in cash to the Fed, plus interest, which the owners of the Fed pocket. In other words, the Fed printed $700 billion in cash, and had they had their way, they would have just stuck it in their pocket, but they can't. So there's an elaborate ruse, what Congressman Lewis McFadden called a defect of law that allows them to put it into circulation in exchange for bonds printed out of fresh air. And then when those bonds mature, they cash them in. The United States Treasury pulls it out of circulation, gives the cash back to them, and it goes back in their pockets. The greatest theft of wealth in history, and it has been ongoing all of your life, not just with that $700 billion. That is exactly how currency is put into circulation in every instance, except it's done with bonds that are hypothecated against your labor. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that later. But go to anyone who really knows how the Fed operates, confirm every word that I just told you, or read some books on the Fed, and you'll see that, by the way, at 4 cents a bill, the Fed is paying 4 cents a bill. When they're returned $700 billion, 4 cents a bill on a $1,000 bill is 2.5% interest. What other word other than insanity would you call it? Or obscene is another applicable word. So with that in mind, Yesterday, I get a call from a member of the de jure grand jury, and those of you who are attorneys out there ought to understand the difference between the word de jure, meaning the original. I hate to use the word original jurisdiction because the Lord is the original jurisdiction, versus de facto. And this party said to me, there's an FBI agent who stopped by who's going to be back in half an hour. I happen to be traveling in that area, coincidentally, and I said, stall him. I'd love to make their acquaintance. And so I drove over there at high speed. I reversed myself, drove over at high speed, and walked in, and there were two fellas sitting there. This was in a so-called commercial business. Walked in and said, fellas, do you believe in the leprechaun? They looked at each other and at me, and I said, because this is your lucky day. I'm Sam Kennedy. And they almost fell off their chairs. Then they stood up. They could not have been more gracious. And I'll tell you, the FBI has sent out some of the finest people around the country to interview grand jurors by the hundreds. They didn't have to send one, by the way, because most of these people, including the folks I spoke to, had no time to prepare. They hadn't read the documents. Had they read the documents, they would have understood there was no risk to anybody. In fact, we are restoring dignity to the United States and sanity to the United States by our process. And we're not trying to impose a will upon anyone, because people will be able to continue in their present form as they so wish. But those of us who are members of the sovereign people, that's a subject we should speak about in a minute. Those of us who are members of the sovereign people do not wish to be treated like subjects any longer. Anyway, before I go into that, let me just compliment the agent I met with and the representative of the State of New York Policy Enforcement Department, the police department, the state police. These were very fine gentlemen, skilled interviewers, and they took very well to the fact that I came to interview them. And my purpose was singular, as was theirs. My purpose was to establish more contacts. The more and more contacts we have, and we have many over the years, the better it is. And I've asked him to meet with me again next week, and he's agreed. And I was genuine in saying, I asked him how many promissory note cases has he participated in. He said very few, because that's not his area. His area is international terrorism. And by the way, I said to him, well, then I know why you were chosen, because they consider this a quote-unquote terrorist situation. And by the way, it's international, because I'm outside the United States Federal Corporation. And he said, well, actually, they chose me because we have a small office. So we had a pretty good laugh, and obviously my credibility was destroyed on the spot, but we continued from there. I also asked him and the investigator from the state of New York if they knew what was said in Section 802 of the Patriot Act. They didn't, of course, and that's the problem. That's why I want to go to the FBI offices and educate them on what they're doing. Section 802 of the Patriot Act, very simply, says I think it's paragraph 5 A and B. It says something to the effect like domestic terrorism is defined as acts which are dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States. Well, folks, smoking, speeding, bungee jumping, dangerous to human life and against the laws, criminal laws. And also acts which appear to be intended to influence government policy by intimidation or coercion. Well, that's just an open category. If grandma signs a petition to the mayor and says, you better do this or we're going to take you out of office, she has just intimidated him and committed an act of terrorism. So they were very willing to be enlightened as to what their law, their so-called laws say that they sometimes bring people in on without really understanding what's in the law. We have all been charged with the crime already of being domestic terrorists if we've sped, if we've smoked, if we've done any of the things that I just discussed. So I hope, you know, during all those debates of the Patriot Act, I remember Alan Coombs attacking one guy. Oh, so you're in favor of terrorism. Not once in the hundreds of debates that I monitored did anyone ever come forward and say, hang on, forget the rhetoric. Do you know what's in Section 802 of the Patriot Act? Let's talk facts. Well, don't worry. No prosecutor would use that against you. Oh, really? And hundreds of prosecutors haven't used the RICO statutes, which were purportedly conceived to restrain the mafia. They haven't used those against priests and lawyers and judges and the AMA and doctors and on and on. Do you really want to put tools to destroy people's lives in young prosecutors fresh out of law school? Not a very wise idea. Anyway, the FBI has implied that this is about sovereign citizens, and that's where I started the interview. I asked this investigator, again, this was a very smart fellow, had almost total recall. I could see how sharp his brain was. Could not have been a more pleasant guy, more unassuming, more perfect for the job. And I really compliment the FBI for hiring people like this and nurturing them. These are wonderful people. And if I've taken any shots at the FBI in the past, I apologize if they were undeserved. So I asked him, do you know what a sovereign citizen is? And he really couldn't define it because there is no such animal. A sovereign cannot be a citizen. You may as well say a stupid, excuse me, I sound like a stupid moron, a stupid genius. There is no such entity. It's an oxymoron. When we return, we'll have a couple of minutes discussion of sovereignty and who we are that sent this letter to the governor, the men and women who occupy the office of governor of the states of the United States. All right. There is no such term. There is no such entity as a sovereign citizen. There is a citizen, which means you are committed to something as a subject, and there is a member of the sovereign people. And it's just shocking that there are dozens and dozens of Supreme Court decisions pre-1860, pre the walkout of the South from this country, that discuss quite clearly the essence of being a sovereign, of being a direct descendant of the king. And it's completely forgotten in modern jurisprudence. No one goes back and remembers their roots. Well, there's a case by the name of United States versus Lee. The reference is 106 U.S. 196. And I, again, apologize to sovereigns who are listening tonight, members of the sovereign people, for quoting United States federal corporation regulations. Here's what the Supreme Court said in that case. Under our system, the people who are there, meaning in England, called subjects, are here called the sovereign. The people in England who are called subjects are here the sovereign. Their rights, whether collective or individual, are not bound to give away to a sentiment of loyalty to the person of a monarch. The sovereign here knows no person, however powerful, to whom he need yield the rights which the law secures to him. Now, compare that to being a tenant on your own deed. Imagine that. And those of you who are attorneys, those of you who are investigative journalists, now maybe you're inclined to ask, if I'm the tenant, who's the landlord? You see, when you file that deed, an act you consider absolutely normal. Every real estate attorney does this. You take the deed and you file it in the incorporated county land records. Instead of filing a land patent, which is derived directly from a land grant from the King of England, you instead file a deed issued by an attorney with an incorporated county, as you will see, just like your little towns and villages say, welcome to the village of Oshkosh, the incorporated such and such a year. That's a corporation, folks. That is not your government. It's a facade. We'll get into that a little later in the program. Well, when you file that deed in the incorporated county, guess what? You have just elected to submit that property to the corporate state and making it taxable by the corporate state, subjecting it to eminent domain, and giving the state, the landlord, who happens to be the governor, a lien right against that property. That's the only way it can be taxed. No one's told you that. But it's the absolute truth. You don't believe me? Don't file the deed with the county. See what happens. There'll be no tax bill. They need your consent for that taxation. Anyway, you can draw that distinction between being a U.S. person. Now, if you want to know what a U.S. person is, just Google 26 USC, like the letters of the University of Southern California, USC 7701. That would be section 7701, the definition section of Title 26 of United States Code. You'll get to that in one Google link. Scroll down to, I think it's subparagraph A1, right at the top. And it'll define person, U.S. person. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, a state, partnership, association, company, or corporation. In other words, artificial entities of the United States Federal Corporation. And when we return, I'll give you some evidence of the corporate government that's in existence around you that's been there all along that you may not have paid attention to. We'll be back with the second hour of Take No Prisoners after a brief commercial message. I'm Dr. Sam Kennedy. Thanks for sticking with us.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
It was December the 6th, 1983. I was doing time for armed robbery. At 4 a.m. I was sitting in my cell. I heard a whistle blow. Then I heard somebody yell.
There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. Up in cell block number 9.
Welcome back, friends. New listeners to Take No Prisoners at the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm Dr. Sam Kennedy. It is really a great pleasure to have you here tonight, folks. I know I'm devoting a great deal of time to some of the more technical stuff, but I want new listeners to understand we're not half-baked in our concepts. Everything I'm telling you, you can look up, and probably all of it in about 10 minutes worth of time. One other point on this U.S. person versus being a sovereign. It's such a difference in concept. We have lost our ability to even think as men and women who are the creators of this country, the descendants of the creators of this country. Public officials work for us. They operate in contract with us under our bond, as you will see when I read you the letter. You know, when you sign a bank signature card, look very carefully, because above your signature or just below the line, it says, "You, period, S, period, person." What an odd thing to say. Why do you have to confess to being a U.S. person to get a bank account? I'll tell you why. Because when you sign that card, you are actually electing to volunteer into the Internal Revenue System. You are agreeing to accept all Treasury regulations, and IRS is working on contract for the Department of Treasury, and you don't know it. Your public officials have actually deemed your signature, uninformed as it may be, as your election to volunteer into a system you might not want to if full disclosure was made. You're volunteering to be treated as a U.S. person, which is an artificial trust account, an accounting trust, that is being held in your name at the Depository Trust Company down in New York City. And how do I know? Because we've tracked those accounts. We called the Portal Alliance and DTC, and they confirmed those accounts by number. We found the CUSIP numbers for our accounts that were created in our name by those signatures. and they're all at DTC being traded. That sounds crazy, makes me insane, but it's true. And those of you in government who have bonds at DTC, you know it's true, and it's about time you told the people. And that's what this process is about. Let me refer you to Title 28 of the United States Code. You might want to Google 28 U.S.C. 3002, Section 3002 of Title 28. It's very easy to remember. I'll never forget the first time I saw it. It says, quote, United States, unquote, means a federal corporation. There's a famous case, Hooven and Allison Company versus EVAT. It's a Supreme Court case, which says it may be merely the name, United States may merely be the name of a sovereign occupying the position, analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations, or it may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends, in parenthesis, District of Columbia, Guam, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, etc. That's the territory where the United States Federal Corporation has jurisdiction. How about this quote out of Miriam's estate? The United States government is a foreign corporation with respect to a state. How about this from Foley Brothers Incorporated versus Filardo? It's a well-established principle of law that all federal regulation applies only within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States unless a contrary intent appears. And there are dozens of other cases. What you've been led to believe is not the actual reality. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back, folks. All right, one last quote. Again, I apologize for using all of the case law out of United States corporate records. This one goes back about 100 years. And I ask everyone listening tonight, open your minds, open your hearts to the Lord, and ask yourself if this at all sounds like you, because this was you 100 years ago, before anyone could tell you how much water to have in your toilet and virtually control every aspect of your life. This is from Hale versus Henkel, 201 U.S. 43. Supreme Court case. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights. He is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. That means no business license. His power to contract is unlimited, as it says in the Constitution. He owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to investigation. Does that sound like what's asked of you on a 1040? He owes no duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom beyond the protection of his life and property. His rights are such as existed by the law of the land. That's the law upon which, by the way, our de jure grand juries were created, not the admiralty law that the United States is currently functioning in. And by the way, if you doubt me, go to any federal court and look at the flag. It has a yellow fringe around it. Sounds like that's just insignificant. Well, folks, when a Lithuanian vessel pulls into New York Harbor, it tells you the law on that ship is the law of the colors it's flying, the Lithuanian flag. And when your courts are flying military naval flags, admiralty flags, they are telling you that the admiralty law, the law of the military, is at play. And that's how we've won so many cases, by going in and arresting judges. I kid thee not, to newcomers to the program. One of the guardian elders arrested three judges in a case, was out in 24 hours with 10 apologies from members of the SWAT team. No joke, true story. He goes on to say, his rights are such as existed by the law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state. In other words, the law of the people. They recognize it exists, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass on their rights. Hale versus Henkel, 201 U.S. 43, at 74, by the way. Does that sound a little different than the world you've come to expect? So when he asked me about sovereign citizens and the FBI issues, one of its usual statements, notice the worst they could say is, this is not a violent process, but it could be interpreted as encouraging violence. Well, that tells you that there's not a lot there for them to be concerned about, and they know it. They know it because they knew about this process before we issued it. No one told you that, did they? We've also issued a process to the U.S. military. You haven't heard a peep out of them, have you? Anyway, this very kind FBI agent had an agenda that really consisted of finding out if there was danger to the governor. That's what he had been told to investigate. He wasn't told by his bosses that they already knew the plan. And he asked, well, who's going to remove the governor if he doesn't comply? And my answer to him was, he's already been removed. And he said, well, yeah, but he's still sitting there. And I said, no, he's been removed. And I turned to the officer from the state and I said, you're a seasoned fellow. You're a tough guy, you know, and you're a good interviewer. What's your arrest record look like? And he said, well, once when I was a kid. And we all laughed. I said, no, no, not how many times have you been arrested? How many times have you slapped iron on people? And he said, about 400. I said, then you're an expert. What's an arrest? And he said, well, it's taking someone into custody. And I said, actually, in our present venue of law, an arrest is a commercial distress. And that's actually the truth. If you were to look in Bouvier's 1856 law dictionary, not legal dictionary, law dictionary, it would tell you that an arrest is a seizure or stoppage, sure. But an arrest in civil cases is the apprehension of a person. U.S. person, sound familiar? By virtue of a lawful authority. Now, any lawyer out there worth his salt will tell you there's only one form of case in the United States, a civil case. They may call it criminal or not, but if you look in the federal rules of civil procedure, Rule 2 was changed back in the 60s to say there's only one form of action, a civil action. And there's a reason for that. Because a corporation cannot prosecute a living man. Corporation can't be injured by a living man. All it can do is charge those commercial trust accounts that they create when mom submits the application for the certificate of live birth, and they ship it on to DTC and set up the trust account, likewise with the application for your Social Security number. And therefore, the United States can only prosecute those accounts, and they expect you to come in and volunteer to substitute for that account. How do I know? Here's your final reference for the evening. 27 CFR 72.11. That's the Code of Federal Regulations, the implementing regulations for so-called law in the United States. 72.11 says, commercial crimes, any of the following types of crimes, federal or state, offenses against the revenue laws, burglary, counterfeiting, forgery, kidnapping, larceny, robbery, white slaving. Tell me, when did kidnapping become a commercial crime? It is when you're in an admiralty court being prosecuted by a corporate employee in de facto, meaning substitute, jurisdiction. And folks, let me tell you something about the de facto and the de jure. The substitute corporate, the incorporated substitute, the illicit corporation functioning as a government, and the original entity. The original entity never ceases to exist. Give you an example. A church. Back in the early 1900s, lawyers convinced churches to apply for incorporation. Now they became incorporated statutes subject to the laws of the state. Previously, as you know, in the first article of amendment of the Constitution, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. It doesn't say there's a separation of church and state. It says Congress is not allowed to intrude on religion. So what did they do? They brought in a special category of religious corporations and convinced you to apply. Same thing with the Internal Revenue Code. When a church applies on Form 1025 to become a religious organization for tax exemption, it says at the bottom of the form in small letters, a church is not required, but there may be some advantage to it, so you can gain access to the courts. What that tells you is that if the church doesn't apply, it retains its immunity from taxation. The right of immunity from taxation is far larger, and control, by the way, by government, is far greater and larger than a privilege of tax exemption. But the lawyers don't tell them that. So the church comes in as a 501c3, and now it's subject to the whims and regulations of bureaucrats. And what did they do? You can't have a politician speak at the scoundrel. But if the church elders understood the real law, they would know that they could. They could simply have a meeting and say, this is the meeting of the church body politic, not the incorporated or 501c3 legal fiction entity. We still exist. How do we know? We're living men and women assembled. We can see ourselves. We know we exist. And so we assemble as that independent church body politic outside of all state regulation. They cannot be visited by the FBI, by the marshals, by Homeland Security. The problem is people have lost their way and don't realize that anymore. So I said to them, he's already been removed. His bond has been arrested. And I think before I comment further on that, I'm going to go right to the letter to the governors. That letter bears the seal of the de jure grand juries, the people assembled under God and somewhat under the original Declaration of Independence, which says that the people reserve the right to abolish and change government at will, because no one's a slave to his government. You have to consent to be governed. I know it's a foreign principle, especially to reporters and journalists, but yes, you have to consent or else you're a slave at the point of a gun. It's entitled The Sovereign People of the United States of America, with a small u, indicating that it was subject to the Declaration of Independence prior to the Constitution. In other words, the law of the land that I just read you in their own cases. And then it says de jure grand juries of the American republics held in original jurisdiction on the land of the United States of America, convened March 24th, 2010. Confidential dispatch for the governor's eyes only. And I list myself and three other very fine men as guardian elders. With great pleasure, you tell me if this is threatening, folks, with great pleasure, the de jure grand juries of the 50 free American republics, in comity with the well-regulated guardians of the free republics, duly assembled in all 50 jurisdictions, meaning men and women in every single jurisdiction simultaneously stood up and put their John Hancocks on a piece of paper saying, I join a de jure grand jury on the land in original jurisdiction prior to the Constitution, and I assemble as a well-regulated, nonviolent, unarmed militia. In other words, a group of people who insist that our rights now be respected. That's not so threatening, is it? And it goes on to say, with great pleasure, the de jure grand juries of the 50 free American republics in comity with the well-regulated guardians of the free republics duly assembled in all 50 jurisdictions have the honor of making your acquaintance and issuing the attached warrant for the arrest of your bond. How's that for a friendly greeting? We'll be back to the meat of this program in about 2 hours. Please stick with us, folks.
On the left, you'll notice a coin slot. Insert dollars only, please.
I got no bread for the rent. I got my next two paychecks spent.
All right, let me read that again. With great pleasure, the de jure grand juries of the 50 free American republics in comity, acting in concert with the well-regulated guardians of the free republics duly assembled in all 50 jurisdictions, have the honor of making your acquaintance. That tells you we're peaceful, we're nonviolent, and issuing the attached warrant for the arrest of your bond. And now you know why I've been talking about some of these subjects as the program has unfolded. What's an arrest? Well, this is not a criminal arrest. It's a civil arrest. We have notified the depository trust company where each of these public officials' bonds is being held on deposit, and the Government Securities Division of the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, a division of the Depository Trust Clearing Corporation. What if we notified them? You're no longer insured to act in a de facto corporate capacity. The office is now reabsorbed into the original de jure capacity on the land, following the law of the land, respecting the Constitution. How terrible. You can no longer just make it up as you go. You can no longer issue executive orders imposing your will on the people. It is back to real law, not admiralty fiction. The people are no longer protected against your misdeeds by your bond. All of your actions are now underwritten either by the people's bond, and we included a bond, a contract whereby we stand behind the governors, the sovereign people stand behind the governors to protect them against accidental misdeeds, or they can rely upon all of their own property and future labor. So when I said to the agent and the state investigator that he was already removed from that office, I wasn't just kidding. How long can he function without the people being protected by a public hazard bond? 3 days. Beyond that, he's on his own. And that's why he has to take the new oath of office, which is similar to the old oath of office with one difference. He expressly recognizes that he is in direct contract with the people, not just some presupposition that, oh, there's this amorphous constitution that he can obey if and when he desires. From now on, his actions are bonded by the people. And as you'll see, we've accepted the contract later on in this first paragraph, so let me reserve my comments further. The letter goes on to say, as of this day, the office of governor with a capital G in each of the 50 incorporated states with a capital S is reabsorbed into the de jure office of governor of the respective republic. In other words, welcome back to the land and the law of the land. It goes on to say the armed forces of the United States, duly presented with lawful de jure authority, in other words, the people assembling on the land in all 50 jurisdictions, are overseeing the implementation of certain general orders pursuant to the attached Declaration of Restoration. Now, the only reason I'm even revealing any of this is because people have taken that declaration and published it all over the web, and they shouldn't have, because these are private matters between us and these men and women, giving them quietly an opportunity to do the right thing, to take the burden off their shoulders and return to being the people's public servants and not just political hacks who make it up as they go along. Every time they want to do something, pass another bill. That's why they call them bills. It's bills that you have to pay, literally. The letter goes on to say, as you may have heard, the free American republics and the de jure United States of America Republic have been re-inhabited by the sovereign people. Now you know what sovereign people means. As an operation of law, proper sovereign authority has been restored. Just like the church members could just restore their sovereignty by simply saying, we're meeting as the church body politic. That's all we did. The people of the United States in every single jurisdiction met and said, we're not telling you what to do. We're just telling you we have assembled to re-inhabit those de jure republics. Do any of you wish to get in our way and tell us we can't? How can we not have the right to re-inhabit the republics that are still there and have been vacated by you? And we go on to say in the letter, you are now operating under the bond of the sovereign people and rightful freeholders on the land. In other words, some of us have land patents. We actually own the land, not deeds to the corporate county. You are now operating under the bond, which is attached, of the sovereign people and rightful freeholders on the land, pursuant to constitutional limitations. How lucky, by the way, and how blessed are the people of the United States that now they understand by virtue of this program that their public officials at the head of each republic are now restricted to their own state constitutions, their own republic constitutions. We went on to say, which, by the way, means foreclosure is going to end over the next month or two, because the state can no longer execute under admiralty law. That is reserved for the United States Republic, and now courts actually have to respect rules of procedure. So if a bank wants to prosecute your mortgage and can't produce the note, your foreclosure is ended. That doesn't sound like such bad news to me. Folks, I hear music, so we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Please stick with us. It gets only better.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back, folks. Again, all media inquiries, we'll be happy to entertain, can be sent to media.therestoreamericaplan@hush.com. As you can see, folks, this is not about anybody imposing their will on anyone else. We do not wish to tend anyone else's garden. You can continue life as you know it and go through your foreclosures and pay the taxes the way you're accustomed, although those things are going to change very shortly as the whole bonding system comes to an end. But we're not going to tell you, we don't want to tell you how to live your life at all. The opposite is true. If you have if you're one of the hundreds of thousands of Americans facing foreclosure to banks that actually loaned you your own money, because under the present system of money, a promissory note, just like a Federal Reserve note, is actually considered an asset, and they enter your promissory note that you sign at the closing on the books as an asset, then they write a check against it, then they circulate that asset, they place it on deposit at DTC again, and they trade against it and issue 9 more loans against it. You'd have to know more about the banking system to understand, but trust me, they are trading on your promissory note and lending you your own money. Believe it, your signature on the promissory note creates the negotiable instrument that in the present system of credit is considered money. Banks trade promissory notes as assets. Whole companies buy and sell them. They bundle them together with real estate trusts and sell them in markets specifically as assets. And you wonder why the system is falling apart, why it's collapsing. The system of credit is predicated upon money laundering. You take a Federal Reserve note, a promissory note, into mom and pop's deli, you buy a corned beef sandwich, they worked hard to give you that work product, and you give them a piece of paper that's a promise to pay. It's only because you believe in it that it has any value. But we are the biggest money launderers on the planet. Their hard work gets exchanged for pieces of currency that are on the verge of falling apart. Anyway, those of you, hundreds of thousands of you facing foreclosure, you now have your remedy in tow, because with admiralty removed from state courts, they have no ability to prosecute you on innuendo. When you say the bank needs to produce the original note, which they never do. I know it sounds crazy, those of you who haven't been through foreclosure. The bank doesn't produce the note because it's been off traded in Europe 10 times over. They can't find the note, literally. Check the court records, see how many cases they were able to produce notes in. None. 1 in 1,000, maybe. And so your foreclosure nightmare has ended. And the tens of thousands of you facing prison for not being able to pay IRS its demands to share in your work product from your sweat and labor, your remedy is here now. The letter goes on to say, excuse me, each of the signatories to the set, oh, this is so important. This is still on page one. Each of the signatories to the said declaration have expressly, by that action, in other words, by the action of signing the declaration, accepted the constitution of their respective de jure republic and the constitution for the United States of America, circa 1787, as binding contracts upon you, thus memorializing their lawful standing and your duty to serve. Now, finally, since 1860, this is the first time we have been back in a binding contract with our public officials, and they must now obey the Constitution or face the penalties. They'll be personally liable. And believe me, among the 1,300 people who signed this, there are many skilled people in contract law. I wouldn't want to go up against them in any court anywhere, whether it's the courts of the de jure grand juries, excuse me, or the courts of the United States of America and these restored republics. As one by one, you're going to see the law venue change, the flags change, the names of the states change from State of New York, a corporate entity, back to the original New York that was a signatory to the Constitution. And by the way, those of you who say the Constitution of the United States, you're not reading from the original Constitution. Check out the original document. It says Constitution for the United States. And the present constitutions that many of you refer to, even in textbooks that say Constitution of, that is the corporate substitute from 1865 with the United States victory at the Appomattox Courthouse. Everything changed, and you don't even know it. One word, when President Clinton said it all depends on how you define the word is, he wasn't kidding. Just change the word is to the word for and of. The original Constitution, which you can check out on the internet, just put in Constitution photo and you'll see photos of the original, is the Constitution for the United States. And the ones in your textbooks that say Constitution of are not the original article. That's why our Declaration says circa 1787. There's been a swindle right under your nose and you don't know it. Excuse me. And finally, the final section, the final sentence of paragraph one, this is all one paragraph on page one, says, with the burden of acting as a corporate agent under color of law lifted from your shoulders, this letter is intended to welcome you back to the brotherhood of mankind in the spirit of forgiveness. You and your children are free. The era of illicit corporations and banking cartels posing as legitimate governments is over. And that's a mouthful if you knew what I knew and what the other 1,300 signatories knew about governance in the United States of America in the 21st century. So that's the opening paragraph, and that's probably enough to whet your appetite for what's coming, or certainly enough to get you to hate us as covert reactionaries, evil men who just dire to be tyrants and threaten people, vigilante militias. Well, actually, as you can see, actually, militia is a tarnished word, but the Constitution has provisions for militias. The Constitution does not have a provision for an army. Do you know that? It says that there can only be a standing army during time of war. Maybe that this national emergency has persisted all these years. The Constitution, your Constitution for the United States of America, provides for a standing navy in Article 1 and for a temporary army. The rest falls on the backs of militias, and that's the truth. Read your Constitution, not just what somebody teaches you in a civics class that he or she was taught by a history professor who was completely ignorant of the history of this country, the most important event being the takeover of this government in 1913 through the Federal Reserve Act. Paragraph 1, page 2, goes on to say, the people, capital P, are committed to a peaceful, honorable and nonviolent transition which unfolds quietly behind the scenes as a mirror image reversal of the 1933 world coup. So I guess our commitment to peace and nonviolence is stated right there. Why would anyone doubt it? It goes on to say, it is the people's intention on behalf of your safety that the general public be no more attuned to the return of their money, law, and freeholdings than it was to their theft in 1933 under Executive Order 6102 and H.J.R. 192. For this reason, all of the events described here under are classified top secret. Obviously, some of the governors have violated that to a degree. I just mentioned Executive Order 6102. For those of you who are not familiar with that and H.J.R. 192, here's what really happened in 1933. In a period of 3 months in every industrialized country, the same laws were passed. In Canada, there were articles of parliament, or acts of parliament, rather, in Australia. In Germany, they burned down the Reichstag, all within the same 3 months, all funded by the same banking cartel. Executive Order 6102, signed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, it may have been April 5th, perhaps, of 1933, said the following. All United States persons, you see the evil of that word, are ordered to turn in all of their privately held gold other than $100 in jewelry to a branch of the Federal Reserve Bank. How do you think the founders would have reacted to that in 1775? You think that would have put them over the edge a bit early? Excuse me. And yet we accept it as perfectly normal. Our great-grandparents had been so beset by the Great Depression, a planned world event, that they actually turned in their gold. And then H.J.R. 192 said the following. All obligations payable in gold are hereafter null and void. From now on, debts can no longer be paid. They can only be discharged. Another legal piece of terminology to pull the wool over your eyes. They can only be discharged in United States currency. Let me tell you what that means. It means that if I owed you $50,000 in gold I had borrowed from you, a third party, the United States, came in and said, you no longer have to pay him back. Well, I've got news for you. The Constitution says Congress shall make no law impairing the obligation of contracts. That obligation of contracts is ancient. Goes back to mercantile law with men on camels traversing the earth. Their word had to be their bond to survive. And it was the obligation of contracts that allowed men to even draw up the Constitution, which is just a contract. So how was Roosevelt able to wave a magic wand and take your gold away and tell you through H.J.R. 192 and the Banking Act, which, by the way, no one read. No one ever read that. Much like today's passage of the health care bill, at least you got 3 days to read that. Back then, the Banking Act was passed with one copy in possession of one House officer. And quietly they passed it in the dead of night. And what it said was that I no longer have to repay you that gold because you can no longer pay anything. We are removing the system of gold and replacing it with a system of credit. Your money was stolen from you under your nose, and the only way he could do it and not be lynched was by making it apply only to U.S. persons. Fictitious trust accounts, United States person slash resident slash citizen, all are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States Federal Corporation, and they took your money. They took your gold away from you at Federal Reserve banks, and they shipped it through Canada overseas. We've seen the invoices on those shipments, and they socked it away in the basement of the Federal Reserve by moving it from one room to another room. From your pockets to the bankers, they paid you $22 an ounce, and 2 weeks later, I think it was, they raised it to $35 an ounce. Who do you think made the bounty on that? You think all of that wasn't planned in advance? So let's not be so naive to imagine that this system of credit is anything other than evil at its inception. And the only way they could do that is by using legal terminology. That's the importance of words in this society. Applying it to U.S. persons, sending the executive order out to members of the Army and the FBI, unfortunately, who thought that that meant it applied to everyone. Well, it applied to no living men and women. It applied only to legal fiction trust accounts. Back then, I don't know where they were on deposit, but nowadays they're on deposit at the Depository Trust Company as of 1963, as I recall. One other thing. For those who think they live in the land of the free and the home of the brave and hate me for stating these things, these are crimes against your children. Executive Order 19, what was it, 41 or 42, passed by Roosevelt. I forget the number of the executive order, 9901 or something like that, or 05, 06. Interning on the stroke of a pen, the entire population of Japanese Americans, there's speculation whether it's 110 to 125,000 people, an entire race of Americans put into prison camps without a warrant, without due process of law, without an appeal, without counsel, without any protection. Tell me it can't happen here. All of my black American friends and my Asian American friends and Indian Americans and Jewish Americans, you all know it can happen. And it's the rest of us Caucasian Americans who have to wake up and smell the roses. Well, we have. And this time the United States got the message. You wild horses couldn't keep me away from that FBI meeting and won't keep me away from the others. I don't sound like this during a meeting like that because I am genuinely blessed and grateful to have the opportunity to sit down with people who have the guns and the power now that we have the authority. We are members of the sovereign people. We are back. And the only thing we demand is that our orders be followed when it concerns our rights, because without our consent, all you have is slavery. You don't have freedom. Don't tell me that I have to do it at the point of a gun, have to produce a piece of paper that indicates I am a subject class citizen in the land of my forefathers. I will not do it. I will not comply. And now I don't have to comply. And all of that is going to change for sovereign citizens. Excuse me. Oh, I apologize. For members of the sovereign people behind the scenes. Because the people have stood. I am so proud of the people. 1,300 of you, many of you trepidatious, you know, many of you don't have the fire in your belly of what I've been doing publicly for the last few years. I don't expect you to. But truth be told now, there are thousands of you who have written to the official, have gone to the official website or written to the official email address of the Restore America Plan at gmail.com. And said, I wish to join. I wish to be a part of this. Thank the Lord that finally the people have woken up. Thousands upon thousands of you. I'll have to hire an army to go through those email addresses and database you all and make it all clean. But at least you can listen to the program. Fortunately, we're heard around the world and understand the importance of the process that is ongoing. Let me say this to each and every one of the men and women occupying the office of governor with a small g now. You are all now in de jure capacity. We welcome you to operate under the law of the land. We welcome you to be out from under the yoke of admiralty and equity. Admiralty was never intended to come on the land into state courts. And anyone who knows law understands that. Unfortunately, most lawyers are not trained a hoot in admiralty. This FBI agent is an attorney, which made it especially gravy on the plate to talk with him. But like every attorney I've ever spoken to, not one has had any training in admiralty law except admiralty attorneys. And they truly know what's going on in the criminal and civil courts of the United States. Well, I'll be back in just a moment, folks, maybe with a couple of more items from this letter. And to let you know who we really are that have come before these governors. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. All right, just time for a couple of comments. Just so you know, none of us are seeking interviews. We're not seeking publicity. We're not seeking glory. The glory truly goes to the Lord. This is an amazing time in history to think that people could and would find the courage, the strength, and the information to come together like this. So I say this to you. If you truly value the future for your children, if you're a reporter or a journalist or a producer, and you truly value the future for your children, and you know that something's not right, then instead of going out and doing a story, why don't you just do some research on the links I've given you tonight? Learn the truth. We don't need any stories to save the country. We don't need to awaken the sleeping American public. Things will change quietly in the background like they did in 1933. You know, in 1933, they held secret meetings with federal judges, and they said laws being replaced by equity and admiralty. There will no longer be any lawful money, so you can't have people pay in court because they can only pay in gold and silver. That's what the Constitution says. Congress shall coin nothing but gold and silver. And so you'll have to have them discharge your debts, and that'll be with promissory notes. So your court's also going to be issuing bonds in every case and on every incarceration. And those bonds, by the way, are also a DTC, and they're being bundled together in real estate trusts and being sold on the backs of our prisoners. Now you know why there are 2 million Americans in prison. It's a booming business. Don't believe me? Talk to the president of the Corrections Corporation of America. And so, I actually forgot where I was, but we don't need to be awakening the public to these things. In 33, when they held that meeting with the judges, not one judge protested and said, by the way, they also told them, you're going to have to get people's consent by tricking them into confessing to being legal fiction accounts substituted in their name under the Social Security system. And not one judge said, that's fine, except I'm issuing a warrant for your arrest. They all complied. That was the bankruptcy of the United States, by the way, in 1933, to the bankers. Take all the gold and all the property by way of deeds and registrations of cars and the like. Now you know why the state gets your title and issues your title. Shouldn't the owner issue title? The state does. You accept it. You accept a marriage license. If I said to you, how do you feel about people in China needing state permission to be married? You'd say, that's awful. Those lousy commie bastards. Well, don't you go to a county clerk here and get permission? Don't they tell you what tests you need to get married? I got news for you. I have a biblical marriage. Two people taking a covenant in front of witnesses under the Lord. It's a covenant with the Lord. It's not a covenant with the state that gives them the right to send social services in to seize your children. You've been deceived and misled, but you can find your way back quietly behind the scenes, because every judge will be visited at the federal level and will now be given the opportunity to come back to law. Every attorney will be given the opportunity to go from a letterhead that says attorney at law back to an attorney in law. Why do you think the attorney's letterhead says attorney at law? The attorneys don't even know why. They just accepted. That's what they were told to do in law school. All of that's going to change. I encourage you, forego the stories. But if you do the story, do your research and bring the truth forward. Because if you don't, then you're going to force my hand to seek out the Glenn Becks and the John Stossels and the others who just might give us a forum. And then the American people would be awakened. I don't want that, because they're going to be angry. This plan states numerous times, we do not wish to awaken hostility in the American people. Everyone can have it any way they want. And if you wish to be a member of the sovereign people, all you'll have to do is act like it, and you'll no longer be a slave to the United States. And the tax situation will be remedied. By the way, the Fed is being rolled back into six centralized divisions for clearing checks. That's it. So with that said, I think we're out of time, folks. Let me thank you for joining me. Thanks to all the new listeners. We'll be here next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Good night. God bless. I'm Dr. Sam Kennedy.